You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Roy Scranton. He's in Los Angeles. Roy, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me on, Brainerd.
Roy, I know you have two books that just came out, so I would ask you what you're working on now, but I imagine it's the reception of those books in a way, and a tour. But perhaps I'm wrong. So what else are you working on at the moment? We'll talk about those books, but what's on your plate at the moment?
Well, Brainerd, right now I have those two books coming out, and I have a couple of pieces, small pieces, I guess, supporting those, but also about. I've got a short piece coming out in the Baffler soon about the recent UN extinction report, and another piece that it looks like it's going to be in the Times, the New York Times Sunday Review, maybe about what the idea of mobilization really means if we talk about climate mobilization, and some of the ways that we need to think about that more deeply. But I'm also, now that I've got these two books coming out right now, I'm also in a place where I get to sort of think about what next. And I'm sort of pulled in two directions. One is to try to think more deeply about what it would really mean to think hard about the possibility of a human future in the catastrophic world that we've created that's emerging right now. And the other is a bit more, it's a bit more fiddling, I guess, while Rome burns. It would like maybe a new novel or a collection of short stories or something more, more artistic focused. I'm sort of figuring out what I'm going to work on next and being pulled in these different ways.
Well, of course, that sounds like it's pulling from the articles that you just talked about, discussing climate change and the state where we're in, right? Those articles directly related to the potential projects that you were just talking about, don't they?
That's right. That's right. I mean, whatever I do next is going to emerge out of ongoing thinking. And I have been, I recently had something in the MIT Technology Review that's sort of in the same line as the forthcoming piece in the Baffler, where I'm really trying to think about how we, and in a way, all of this is a continuation of the project that began with Learning to Die in the Anthropocene, which is trying to come to terms in a kind of existential and philosophical way with the apocalyptic and catastrophic world that of climate change, and not just climate change, right, but like total environmental collapse, right? If you read the UN report on extinction and the biosphere degradation, right, it's a pervasive problem, not limited to climate change, but throughout the entire Earth system. It's going to all unfold. It's unfolding right now, and it's just going to keep accelerating during our lifetime. And we have to figure out how to live with this in a way that is maybe more engaged than just getting on Twitter, right, or like binge watching a documentary on Netflix, right? We have to think about it more deeply.
And so let's talk about that a little bit. Because this is a topic everyone's interested in. It's interesting in this interview series, I've talked with different artists, writers, and poets who some are addressing this in different ways. Some are addressing it as, what's the next planet we're moving to? What's life going
right.
to be like somewhere else, like the moon or Mars when, we're second generation Earthlings or first generation, wherever we're going. But that's, of course, kind of escapist in a way, and doesn't deal with the
Absolutely.
Realities that you're talking about. So, what are some of the strategies? Is it possible to discuss some of that? I mean, I imagine some of that's in your articles or your thinking now.
Yeah.
But it seems to me there's, when I think about it, I think, moving north or but that's not also very, very right. active. That's you know, trying to like save my family or something. It's not right. it's not an active engagement with what's happening. So what are some of the ways
right.
that you imagine we can engage or move forward in a productive way?
The most challenging step is going to be the first one, which is coming to terms with the inescapability of the situation and the sort of all-encompassing character of the predicament that we find ourselves in, right? We want to find an escape route. We want to believe that we can figure out a way, right? Whether that means moving to Canada or some kind of, you know, moon base or, you know, Peter Thiel's fortress in New Zealand, whatever shape that might be, or even the kind of utopian promises of a revolutionary Green New Deal that's going to completely transform the economy and save everyone and give everyone jobs and keep capitalism going and so on and so on. Right. We all have these different, there's a real spectrum of basically utopian fantasies that we play through, right, when we're trying to figure out what to do about the situation. But the fact of the matter is that the situation's like, in terms of environmental degradation, in terms of climate change, it's already too far gone to be able to escape, right? We're at a point now where the amount of carbon already in the atmosphere and the feedback mechanisms that are already happening, right, are going to increase temperatures beyond a point where it will be easy to manage, and possibly beyond the point where we could even easily stop the accelerating increase in global temperatures, right? So we're, it's kind of, you know, I'm not saying that, like, you know, we're all doomed totally, right? Who knows, right? Lots of things could happen. But the fact of the matter is that the world that we live in now, the world that we understand and move around in, and where we buy milk and go to Target and order books on Amazon or what have you, right? Like, that world is not sustainable. It will not survive, right? And it's either going to collapse in a violent and kind of ugly way, or, you know, there might be some kind of possible revolutionary political transformation, which is seems highly unlikely. So we, in any case, right, what we need to come to terms with is the end of this way of life, right? Which means what we think is good, which means the way we construct a life, the way you think you move through a life, how we have children, how we eat, how we move around together. All that we need to accept that it's transient and it's passing, and that it's no longer viable. Until we begin to accept the end of the world as we know it, right, we have no hope of imagining a new or adapting to the new world that we've created, right? That's the hard first step that nobody, that most people don't want to take, is right, is sort of sitting with what we've lost and sitting with the feelings of grief and fear and anger at the fact of losing the natural world, the thousands of species going extinct, the fact that, you know, whatever hopes we might have had for a good life in late capitalist America, right, they're not going to happen. Right. The you know, clean air, clean water, open borders, all these possibilities, they're gone. And we need to begin to come to terms with the loss of that world in order to have any hope of moving forward.
So that's not an easy thing to swallow. I mean, that's I guess part of the existential problem, the angst, the fear, the reason why it's preferable not to even think about this, right? It's such a tough subject, kind of like our own demise. It's such a tough subject to approach in a level-headed way. Maybe level-headed isn't the right way, but just a psychological, emotional way. You know, we're talking about not just our own death, but the death of the planet, the species. Is it possible to come to terms with that? It sounds like it's as difficult as imagining ourselves dead or some other related scenario.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, right? The one of the most difficult philosophical problems that humans have ever faced has been confronting the fact of our own mortality, like on an individual way, right? Just confronting the fact of our own death, right? That's been a key problem in philosophy since the beginning, and some even say, right, that this is the beginning of philosophy itself, right, is learning how to die, right? So that's on an individual level. That's just considering one's own death and, like, thinking about one's own transience. When we scale that up to the problem of the end of the civilization, the death of a civilization, right, it becomes much more difficult. You know, and how we do that is a real challenge, and that's where, you know, I think that's where important work remains to be done, is to think through how we can frame this, and how we can practice acceptance, and then begin to think into the unknown future. There's a book I've been thinking a lot about lately by the philosopher Jonathan Lear called Radical Hope. And it's essentially a philosophical book looking at the way that the Absaluka tribe, the Crow people of the North American plains, managed the transition from being a free nomadic warrior people to being a conquered, sedentary agricultural people. And Lear argues that part of the way that they made this transition was through understanding it and framing it as a loss of a world of meaning, and yet finding a way to believe that the future could hold new possibilities for meaning. Lear talks about hunting the buffalo and, the way that the Crow considered space, the way that they organized space, and how they counted the seasons and all these different things, and tracks, especially through the writings and recitations of the last great Crow chief, Plenty Coup, right? How the Crow came to terms with this catastrophic, tragic loss of a world, right? They lost their world. It no longer meant anything to hunt buffalo in the same way, right? And, like, their lives no longer carried the same meanings once the white men had come and conquered the plains, and yet they found a way to go forward. So this is one example, right? We can look to various moments in history when cultures have been threatened with the catastrophic annihilation of their world, right? It happened in the New World with the conquest of the Americas. It's happened to other cultures over and over again. The Old Testament is an account of one culture's persistent encounter with the possibility, with the abyss of cultural annihilation and their persistence through those moments. So we can look to history, and we can look to moments when other human cultures have coped with this catastrophic loss of the world for possible ways that we might begin to adapt and survive through this moment that we face.
You know, I just recently finished Sapiens, and I'm reading the second book by that author, Homo Deus, and he talks a little bit about, of course, a historian that's talking about the progress of the whole of fairly recent history, and he doesn't really broach the subject too much of annihilation or environmental collapse, but he does talk about the idea that, you know, especially in his second book, that evolution isn't going to be the process that it was, that we're going to kind of upgrade ourselves genetically, more or less, to be superior beings in some way. And, you know, what that seems to leave out or infer is that survival will be for the wealthy, and that everyone else who's not able to genetically manipulate themselves to handle new superbugs or temperatures or whatever is going to die. I mean, he doesn't say that directly, but, you know, since we're talking about capitalism and the potential collapse of it, isn't that a huge part of this picture, that those who have money, like you're saying, Peter Thiel building a fortress, or other people that are super wealthy, have a very different sense of what survival means than for all the people in places like Samoa, where when the water rises another inch, you know, they're all going to have to be evacuated, millions of people. And so is that, I mean, is that, do you think, part of the equation here that's difficult to manage is that this is going to be ultimately about who has the financial ability to manage this? Or is that not the case, you think?
I mean, I think we need to, you know, we definitely need to understand how strenuously global elites are working right now to protect themselves and to secure themselves and to defend themselves against this emerging world, right? That's really happening, and it's not, it doesn't work to the favor of everyone else on the planet, right? And there's a worldview there that I think opens up into this fantasy of the wealthy being able to survive whatever disaster comes through technology, through genetic engineering, through having well-paid enough guards. And I think, you know, I think it's, who knows, that seems like a viable possibility, the emergence of a new feudalism under conditions of, you know, the worst economic inequality that the world has ever seen, right? It seems all too likely. It seems like it's already happening, right? It doesn't even seem like a possibility. It seems like it's really happening right now. And yet, two other factors sort of raise interesting questions about that. The first is that climate change and environmental degradation are pervasive and ecological, right? It's not actually something you can escape from. You can build a biosphere. You can build a little dome, right, to protect yourself. But even that, right, as the one they built in Arizona, I believe it was, shows, like, it doesn't seem to work that well. And there's only so much you can protect against if it's the weather and the trees and the seas and the wind, right, that are rising up against you. You know, so I'm in LA right now, and, you know, I'm very cognizant of the wildfire season that's getting going, right? It doesn't seem that bad here yet this year, but last year, remember, like, you know, poor people poor people's homes were destroyed, and so were the homes of the wealthy, right? The fire doesn't care how much money you make, and you can't, while wealth does allow you to sometimes hire, you know, a private firefighters to help out or some kind of service to help extract you, it does protect you in certain ways, it cannot protect you completely. And it's the same with rising seas. It's the same with increasing temperatures, right? There's only so much that can be done. The other thing, the other aspect is that we see a rising tide of populism in politics in countries all over the world. And right. Part of that, part of what is driving that is a sense of resentment and outrage at the vast inequality that is more and more shaping the world that we live in. You know, from the Gilets Jaunes in France to even the, you know, some of the resentment that drove the Trump election here, right? Even if it gets turned back against the poor, you know, the poor who are in support of it, like it's in complex ways. Nevertheless, right, there's real, I think, an increasing resentment against the wealthy, against elites for their arrogance and their, you know, the way that they've worked to protect and secure their own lives while leaving the rest of us to drown and burn. And that, you know, that's only going to get worse, right? So it may not result in, you know, a revolution, but, you know, we will see more populism. We will see more rioting. We will see more mindless acts of aggression against, sometimes against the wrong targets. But this kind of violence and instability is only going to increase. The political violence and instability is only going to increase as the elites try to increase their control of society in order to protect themselves. And so who knows how that's going to end? You know, it could go lots of different directions. But I don't think it's going to be a happy story about, you know, yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
Right. Well, it's great talking to you about this as exciting as it can be to talk about something as dark as these subjects, but it seems so important to be continually addressing. And I want to ask you about your books that just came out, the recent books.
Sure.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So I'm happy to talk about these. So they're two very different books. The first is a work of literary scholarship. It's called Total Mobilization, World War II in American Literature. And it comes out of work I've been doing on war and the role of the veteran in American society for a long time. And it's sort of the completion of a lot of that work. And it builds, it's related to and builds on an essay I published a few years ago about the concept of the trauma hero. And basically that book is looking at how trauma emerged to become the dominant understanding of war in American culture and American literature, and how and what complications and contradictions that understanding has obscured or left out or helped us forget, right? So the arc is basically the book basically takes us from World War II and real problems that World War II opened up in American society between nationalism and capitalism, you know, between the racial caste system and the need for total mobilization. All these problems World War II opened up and made obvious in American society, and writers worked to, you know, from James Jones to Wallace Stevens to later writers like Joan Didion and even people like Martha Gellhorn and Ralph Ellison. World War II really shaped or presented these problems for them to understand that they worked to explore in their work. And then in the 60s and 70s, all that was sort of covered over and in some ways erased by this new story of trauma, where the story of war isn't about society or politics or how we organize ourselves collectively, but rather the story of individual American, usually men, who have suffered psychologically for their for the violence that they've enacted on others, right? Which is a profound transformation to shift focus from war as a political event to war as like this metaphysical, spiritual moment is massive, and that's the transformation that the book charts. Total mobilization, World War II in American literature. The other book is a novel called I Heart Oklahoma. And it's about three, it's from Soho Press, it just came out. It's about three New York artists making a road movie about a sort of an art movie, art film, about Donald Trump's America. So they're kind of slightly unhinged artists, one particularly the filmmaker and then a writer and his, the filmmaker cinematographer. They get in a Plymouth Valiant and they head out across the country. Various things happen. You know, there's some sexual tension and then things kind of go off the rails. And really the novel is it's a kind of lyrical, it's a lyrical and dare I say it, even experimental, meditation on or engagement with what it means to live in a country, a nation built on the idea that you can just get in a car and drive anywhere and become free, right? And what that means as the world changes around us, right? Because in some ways, right, Trump isn't just... He's not just this ogre that appeared out of nowhere, right? He's a deeply American figure. He represents a kind of individual sovereignty that has been, that's written into the DNA of American culture and really grew to monstrous size in the 20th century. He's an avatar of that. But it doesn't come out of nowhere, right? It's in our automobiles. It's in our highway system. It's in people like Charlie Starkweather and Jesse James and Bonnie and Clyde, right? That now, you know, is replicated in these terrible mass shootings. There's something awful and violent, in the heart of American culture. And I'm trying to get at that and see if there's a way past it.
Right. It's been really been a pleasure talking to you about your work and your books. But of course, there'll be links to in this interview for people to find out more about. I want to ask you what you're reading at the moment. What's on your nightstand?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm reading a couple things. I'm reading The People of Chaco, about Chaco Canyon and the civilization that rose and fell there, which is a fascinating look at what happens when the temperature, with minor changes, minor fluctuations in the climate, can cause major fluctuations in human societies. It's really, really interesting. And I'm also reading a short book by the German writer Ernst Jünger called The Forest Passage. It's from the 50s. It's sort of him thinking about what freedom means in the wake of Nazi Germany. I'm also reading Jane Austen's Emma for fun, I guess, and partly because I'm thinking about updating it for the Anthropocene. And then some other stuff. I typically have like six books going at the same time. A great book by a Palestinian poet. It's called Adrenaline, and his name is I'm not gonna get it right. It's Gayath I'm not going to, I can't remember it exactly. But it's called Adrenaline. It was put out by Action Books. It's really incredible, staggering, astonishing, poetry. Yeah. So that there's that.
Thank you so much, Roy. It's really been a pleasure. I appreciate your time and your work.
Thanks for having me on, Brainerd. It's been nice talking to you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.